The February 21st meeting of the House Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules to order, and open a public hearing on House Bill 2082. And colleagues, we have a few more witnesses signed up to testify on this bill, and it looks like there might be still some more out there. There is quite a bit of written testimony in front of you in addition to what we've already been provided, so take a look at that. Also take a look at your agenda, because behind the agenda, in addition to the staff measure summaries, are some additional things on 2082. So we will just go through the list in order, and the first person on it is Ross State. If you'd like to come forward. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Ross Day, Director of Legal Affairs, Oregonians in Action. I emailed all of you a 14-page letter, which I'm sure you've all read and studied in detail, and are prepared to ask me detailed questions on it. I appreciate the opportunity today to come and testify on House Bill 2082. Apologize for not coming sooner. I've had some issues outside the building that I've had to take care of, and today is the first day I've been able to make a committee hearing. I'm a veteran of these wars, if you will. Senate Bill 102, which was 2003, Senate Bill 164, which was 2005, and now House Bill 2082 all address the ballot title shopping issue and some of the other initiative issues. And as I'm sure everyone is aware, Oregonians in Action is particularly interested in how the legislature deals with some of these issues, because we're oftentimes a customer, if you will, of the initiative process, starting with Measure 56 back in 98, of course, Measure 7, Measure 37, which I don't know if any of you have heard about, but if you will, I'm happy to brief you on it, and most recently Measure 39. As they're currently written, we oppose the House Bill 2082, the Dash 2 amendments, the Dash 1 amendments. My letter's based, by the way, on the Dash 1 amendments. But rather than tell you all the bad stuff about the bill, because I'm sure you've heard plenty of that, Madam Chair, I'd like to maybe touch on a couple quick legal points and then offer some suggestions, if I could, maybe make it a much better bill, at least a bill that we could probably get behind. And before I get to that, I heard Mr. Limbach's testimony on, I don't remember if it was Monday or Friday, about what his office does when they go through the process. And, they take over the Lobby Message Center and they go through all the petitions. It really is an impressive process, and they do a fantastic job. And if you haven't had that opportunity, I strongly say they really do a absolutely fantastic job. I don't know how they do it. It's absolutely amazing to me, and they deserve a lot of credit for it. So with that, there's a couple of issues, constitutional issues, that the committee should be aware of with the Dash 2 amendments. There's a couple of Supreme Court cases directly on point, U.S. Supreme Court cases directly on point, that specifically has held that the registration requiring a petition circulator to register, the identification requirements of the Dash 2 amendment, or at least the Dash 1 amendments, some of the disclosure requirements that the chief petitioner disclose the identity of petition circulators. The Supreme Court in Buckley versus ACLF. It's a.
Supreme Court guy.
This is a Colorado case. A lot, for some reason, a lot of the initiative cases come out of Colorado, but the Supreme Court specifically on those three issues held them to be unconstitutional, violating the First and 14th Amendments of the U.S. Constitution. Further, the ban on payment, if you will, there's a provision there that says you can't pay somebody until they register. I would submit to you that that probably violates Meyer, the Meyer versus it's another Colorado case. I can't recall the one of the who the defendant was. It was Secretary of State of Colorado at the time. That likely violates Meyer. The test, just maybe to guide you in this, that the court, that the Supreme Court applies, is the court has said in Meyer that circulating a petition is core political speech, and anything that the legislature does to inhibit my ability to circulate a petition burdens my ability to engage in core political speech and is therefore unconstitutional. And so, in the Buckley case, in registration, the identification requirements and the disclosure requirements, there were specific facts in that case that demonstrated that circulators would not come to Colorado in this case to ply their trade. That would reduce the number of petition circulators, which would reduce my ability to engage in core political speech, which, as a result, infringes on my First Amendment rights. That's the guiding principle. If we're talking about a regulation that's going to reduce the number of paid circulators, or even volunteer circulators for that matter, is going to come to Oregon and ply their trade and circulate petitions, regardless of what the topic is, chances are it's going to violate the principles of Buckley and Meyer. In addition to that, a big concern that we have is with the measure summary provisions, where the where you're not allowed to challenge the measure summary. I think that likely violates Article 7 of the Oregon Constitution and the separation of powers. I don't know that you can completely preclude a challenge altogether, a constitutional challenge, for instance. So that might be something that the committee might want to look at. But those are just some of the constitutional concerns, and they're articulated in more detail in my letter. But I want to get to the ballot title shopping provisions, because that, of course, that's a concern of ours as well. In the interest of full disclosure, I submitted 11 ballot measures in the last election, all on ballot measure 39, because we felt we had to get a good ballot title. I'm not sure that I agree that you have to have a good ballot title to pass a measure, but everyone who's smarter than me tells me that so that's why we did it. I wish it wasn't necessary. I wish we had a process that didn't make ballot title shopping necessary. Unfortunately, sometimes you get ballot titles that don't make any sense. Frankly, you know, Measure 37, we get a lot of comments about the ballot title on that. And we still maintain that ballot title was inaccurate, which is a surprise. People say, wow, I can't believe to hear you guys say that. And Measure 39, I think, was inaccurate as well. But if the real goal of House Bill 2082 is to eliminate ballot title shopping, I would suggest that you eliminate ballot titles altogether. What's the purpose of a ballot title? The ballot title, aside from being on a initiative petition, which you've already addressed using a measure summary, informs the voter at the time they cast their ballot. I would suggest to you that you use something more along the lines of an explanatory statement committee, or I call it an explanatory title in my letter, where after a measure has actually qualified for the ballot, then you convene a committee. What we do with the explanatory statement committees, if you haven't seen that, it's a public process. It's an open public process where opponents and proponents of the measure get together and they draft an explanatory statement. I don't know why you can't just use that process, and instead of having them draft an explanatory statement, have them draft the ballot title, and the legislature is free to include whatever parts, you know, if you want a caption or a result statement or whatever, you're free to include any of that in the explanatory statement.
On that note,
Mr. Riblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On that note, could it just be the title number? Do you even need a title? I mean, just have it. Ballot number 35.
Yeah, that's Madam Chair, Representative Roblin. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we wouldn't object to that either, getting rid of ballot titles altogether. But I do think that they serve a purpose to inform the voters at the time they cast their ballot. And so I would still, advocate having something at the outset to inform the voter. So, and this was detailed in my letter, a little bit more about the pros and cons of using an explanatory process. There's just a couple other explanatory title process. There's a couple other changes I'd just like to bring to the committee's attention, and hopefully you can address. One of them is the law says, and there's an amendment in 2082 that says that once a contractor or once a chief petitioner becomes aware of a violation, you're held to be in violation unless you notify Secretary of State a day after learning of the violation. This is a problem that we wrestle with all the time in our office. I'll get a letter from the Secretary of State alleging to have a violation, that there's an alleged violation of election law, and so then I turn around and write a letter to the Secretary of State saying, I have reason to believe that there's a violation of election law, because the point is, what does knowledge mean? Does knowledge mean when I get a letter back from the Secretary of State, do I need to send a letter back saying, hey, by the way, you just told me there might be an election law violation? So that might be something that, just clean that up, just to make that a little more clear.
Mr. Day, I'm not sure I'm following
okay.
What you just said.
Under the law, you are required to notify the Secretary of State, if you're chief petitioner, of an election law violation, if you become aware of an election law violation or an alleged one. When the Secretary of State sends you a letter, when somebody files a complaint, the Secretary of State sends you a letter saying, we have reason to believe that there is an election law violation. Well, at that point, then, are we required to send a letter back to the Secretary of State informing him of this alleged election law violation? Because of the way the statute's written, it's unclear whether or not you have to, in order to absolve yourself of the liability, protect yourself from any of that liability. That's just something that I'd ask the committee to take a look at. And the last thing is there's a change in here about who gets to file a statement of organization for a measure committee. And it goes from a chief petitioner to a treasurer. And the only thing I would suggest is that you allow chief petitioners or the treasurer to file the original statement of organization, because oftentimes what happens when you start a measure and you start your committee, you may not have your treasurer right away, but you need to file your statement of organization in order to be able to open a bank account, in order to provide that information to the Secretary of State, in order to get a treasurer. So that might just make life a little easier on everybody. So with that, I really appreciate the opportunity, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, questions for this witness? Looks like there are none.
Great.
If I could just make a comment. Ross, appreciate you coming in. I haven't read your memo yet. That's why I don't have any questions. But I think some of these are very good suggestions and sort of practical things that would make the process better. Thank you.
Thank you. And you all know how to get a hold of me. I'm happy to answer any questions about anything, even Measure 37 if you need to. So thank you very much.
Okay, thanks a lot. Next, we'll hear from Rick Bennett. Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, for the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP Oregon. I appreciate you having this hearing this morning. I was unable to attend the last couple of hearings you've had on this bill as well, and I did want to have the opportunity to comment. If I could, I'll be brief, but I'd like to share our AARP's experience related to the initiative process, as well as make some specific comments to previous testimony. Unlike Mr. Day and Argonians in action, AARP was a novice to the initiative process, and frankly, yeah, except for one or two instances, AARP has never participated in the gathering of signatures in any state. And I think primarily that's because that we really are very supportive of our representative form of government. We believe that the legislature is the place where the debate and deliberation should take place. Unfortunately, last session, we didn't think that there was particularly good debate or action on one bill related to prescription drugs. And with that in mind, and looking to the future, we decided that we would take some other form of action to have our issue heard. Our state director, Jerry Cohen, along with State Senator Bill Morissette, were co-petitioners on Initiative Petition 122. And I had the honor, I suppose, of being the kind of coordinator of that effort. We decided that we would try to utilize our membership, which currently is just under 500,000 here in Oregon, to gather signatures. AARP's contribution to the effort was, in fact, direct mail to those members to over 300,000 households, and working with other community partners such as SEIU, Our Oregon, Oregonians for Health Security, as well as Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, designed a plan to utilize volunteers, paid gatherers, as well as the direct mail. And as you know, we were successful. We gathered approximately 129,000 signatures, and ballot measure 44 passed by a significant margin in the November election. It certainly was an interesting experience for us. We learned a great deal. At the first hearing, Representative Greenlink indicated that it was also a very interesting experience for him, but he thought it would be a one-time experience. I would say that AARP, based on our experience, and we think we've learned a great deal, and we think we can do it more cost-effectively next time around, we don't necessarily see it as a one-time experience. We'd certainly hope that, again, our issues are get a good hearing here in the legislature, but if there's something that our members feel very strongly about, I think we'd go to the initiative process again if we have to. With that, I'd like to just provide a couple of comments related to the bill, or the amended bill as I understand it. And these primarily are comments related to direct mail. It's my understanding, I think it was suggested, well, it's my understanding that only paid gatherers would be required to register and to go through some type of training and so forth, although it was suggested that perhaps volunteer gatherers should be included in that as well. Volunteers are one thing, but that would be very problematic for any organization using direct mail, obviously, because you really don't know who that volunteer is until after they mail the signature sheet back to you. Also, the official templates of cover and signature sheets being sequentially numbered, it's my understanding that there could be gaps in that numbering. So if that's the case, then that doesn't present a problem as far as direct mail. If you had to have every sheet back, then obviously, again, you can't do that.
And just to clarify, it isn't necessary to return every sheet, but the numbering provision was there in the original Secretary of State proposal to prevent just sort of, you know, misuse of the process. By
That's my understanding, and that's correct, then we have no problem with that either. Also, we were very careful in distributing our signature sheets, very careful to state that we didn't want people making copies of those signature sheets, that we would provide additional sheets when needed and so forth. So, again, the sequential numbering in that regard I don't think presents a problem, at least as far as we're concerned. Representative Greenlink did bring up an interesting issue related to signature sheets that only had one signature on them. And we received a great many of those. And I got notes and phone calls from people saying, why do I have to witness my own signature. And, in fact, one person I talked to for some time on the phone and would not believe me that, in fact, this is the way it must be done. And I finally said, I think you need to call the Secretary of State's office because I'm not getting through on this. But, again, I think it might be helpful just say if you only have one signature, that, in fact, you don't need the additional signature of a circular as well. As long as all the personal information is there for that one signature, it shouldn't have to be duplicated again. As I said, we would prefer not to to have to go this route, but I think certainly I understand. I've only lived in Oregon 3 years, but I understand the history related to the initiative process and how strongly citizens feel about this. And I think it's in everybody's interest that we protect the integrity of the initiative process. However, based on what I've seen and heard over the past year, with my involvement in the initiative process, I'm very concerned about the integrity of the process. I think we do need reform. I think there has to be adequate enforcement of those reforms. That would suggest to me that the Secretary of State's office needs to be adequately funded to enforce these reforms. I think it's just important to safeguard the integrity of the initiative process. And I haven't read the Dash 2 amendments yet, but I think my testimony is related to what I understand your intent to be, and we support that intent. So any questions, be happy to try and answer them. One other thing I would say, again, being a novice, we relied on our community partners to advise us. We relied a great deal on the Secretary of State's office, and the staff in the office there were, as far as I'm concerned, fantastic. They were very helpful, always responsive, always getting us the correct interpretation of what we needed to do and so forth, and I really appreciate their assistance.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Right. Questions for this witness? Vice Chair Berger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did you indicate that you did use paid circulators on your petition?
Chair Rosenbaum, Vice Chair Berger. Yes, we did. Now, we as a part of the petition committee, we accepted contributions, and we utilized those for paid gathering as well as our in-kind contribution from our direct mail efforts.
Okay. What percentage? Thank you. What percent? Do you have a? You got what? 129,000. What? Do you have any notion of what percentage of that came from paid as opposed to volunteer?
It was about probably about 25 to 30% volunteer, and the remainder paid gathering. And I might add that we ARP is very concerned about our credibility, our name, and we were very concerned about which contractor we would hire for those paid signatures, and based on a fair amount of review and talking to different people who had participated in this process and so forth, we utilized Ted Blazak to do our paid gathering campaign because we understood him to be someone who not only was very concerned about the letter of the law but the spirit of the law as well, and we were very happy with his services. I heard his testimony that he provided on this bill, and I would, you know, I believe when he says that this can be done without great difficulty, I believe him.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since you are at this interesting place where you've both a significant amount of volunteer signature gathering but also the paid, do you think, I mean, obviously in this bill it raises the bar and helps educate the public about whether they are signing something by a paid signature gatherer or by a volunteer. Do you think, since you've used both, do you think that's a legitimate distinction, a legitimate thing to have to educate the public about?
I think it is good to know who that person is, and that in fact they have been checked out to some degree. There is some credibility that the person on the corner there is who they say they are, and that in fact hopefully what they're saying is accurate. I would, you know, I think if we were to do this again, we would utilize our membership not only through direct mail, but also in gathering the signatures directly. And even in that, I'm sure that we would provide training to them, just as you would paid gatherers.
Mm-hmm. Another question from Vice Chair Berger.
Yeah, you do sit in a unique position, having had a successful petition that had both and a fairly clean, straightforward one. What do you or your organization have any thoughts about the provisions in here about not having extraneous markings or changing dates or some of those? It occurs to me that your sort of unique constituency, we all those of us who remember how to write a check remember that when you make a mistake, you cross it out and you put your initials on it, and you know, that kind of thing. And that would be disallowed here, and I'm really bothered by that, because I think it hurts the earnest citizen and doesn't necessarily solve the problem of the corruption of the process. Would you speak to that a minute?
Chair Rosenbaum, Vice Chair Berger. At times, I mean, we went through our signature sheets very closely. Last year, we utilized our volunteers primarily to process those signature sheets and so forth, review them to make sure that they were filled out correctly and so forth. We learned a great deal as far as from the first mailing we did to the second one that we did, and we made changes to more clearly explain how the signature sheet should be filled out, what you could do, what you couldn't do. We provided a sample sheet that was a different color with little balloons and arrows and so forth on it and so forth, and then we still had people actually sign and send back the sample sheet. So, to some extent, you always have some differences. One of the previous people testifying indicated that they, whenever possible, sent sheets back to be correctly completed and so forth. We did the same thing. We probably sent back a couple thousand signature sheets because of one issue or another. I understand that some things seem to be kind of nitpicking. And I would certainly hope that a valid signature was not tossed out because of some little mark on the page and so forth. I guess to some extent it's a judgment call. But I just think you want to make sure that it is a valid signature and it's not being forged or some way changed after the fact.
Other questions? Okay, thanks very much for
your
testimony. Next, we'll hear from Andrea Meyer. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. The ACLU has a long history of being involved in the initial process, and I should say from the outset that, you know, we do believe it's part of the fundamental fabric of citizen involvement, and I am here today, though, to express some process concerns we have specifically with the ballot summary, ballot title portion of the bill. We have a cadre of the most excellent volunteer attorneys in this state who have given us thousands of hours where they are not compensated, and we certainly make no money off of being involved in the initial process. While the ACLU is nonpartisan and we do not take position on individual candidates, we do take positions on ballot measures, and we have been involved from the very beginning when the initiative is filed to the very end when we sue on it. Indeed, part of my professional history, and probably not the highlight, is my own involvement in the initiative process. I first handled a case for the ACLU before I was employed, where at the time the ballot summary portion of the ballot title was 85 words long. This was at a time when you got to go to the Supreme Court and make your argument. I was allied with some other parties who had concerns about this initiative. We made our written case. We made our oral case, and the court subsequently ruled and said, you know, I was right. That was a relevant piece of information that the voters needed, but there wasn't enough room. So I got other provisions at the end of the ballot summary. That was the language I was responsible for. And I have my name connected to some challenges more recently that I am also not pleased with the court decision on. But be that as it may, you may not know our history a little bit, but we have been involved both in, as I said, the ballot title comment as well as what is called the procedural issue. Does something comply with our Constitution, particularly when we're amending our Constitution? We are responsible for the Armada decision, which started the analysis of looking at multiple amendments and ensuring single subject. We were recently more responsible. We are responsible for what still is an area of law that has not been clarified sufficiently, but the full text requirement, simply the same that you all have to comply with when you do legislation. We think the voters should see what statutes are being amended in the full context. Likewise, we participate in this year's ballot cycle, and I can tell you that a proponent filed two initiatives. We filed ballot title comments on one. We had our concerns were sufficiently addressed that was all we did. We did not challenge it at the court. However, on the other one, we had concerns were rejected, and we filed to the Supreme Court, and they agreed with us. And having that neutral body review and assure that the process is adhered to and that the ballot title accurately reflects is critical. One of the concerns I have is just in terms of the 75-word summary. Having struggled with now the requirements, the summary and the ballot title, you've got the caption, which I believe is 15, the yes and the no are 25, and the summary is 125. You know, it's a struggle for us to capture what is really going on. You know, what's attractive about that particular layout is it does allow voters and people who are going to sign initiatives to get the caption, hopefully read the yes and no, and in an ideal world, read the rest of it. People have a limited attention span and limited opportunity to read. And I'm worried about 75 words being pretty constrained and also kind of what the layout is going to be. And I just raise that as a concern. But more importantly, I am concerned because the ballot summary process, while it allows us to make comments, does not allow us to challenge it when the AG might not get it just right. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. It all depends on your perspective. So what I'm concerned about is my understanding in looking at the amendments is that you need to collect 10%. And then you can go through the ballot title process where people can comment again. And if they're not pleased, whomever they are, if they file comments, they can challenge it. I'm concerned if the proponents get a ballot summary that they really like, that they continue to carry it beyond the 10% and collect 90% or even potentially 100%, trying to skirt the ballot title process. So we would hope and look for something that would be a maximum of how many you can collect under the ballot summary. Likewise, as that is looked at in terms of what that maximum might be, we'd be concerned that if someone makes, that there needs to be a little bit of wiggle room. Let's say you say it needs to be no more than 10%, but if upon counting and you good faith submit a sufficient number that you believe will be actually 10%, and indeed it's 14%, that we don't disenfranchise that 4% and say you can't count them. Because they can't sign it again, likely when it becomes through the ballot title process petition. Because they'd be signing it twice, and we wouldn't necessarily know who has signed and who hasn't. So we want to give some flexibility, but very concerned if someone could skirt the ballot title process by living with a ballot summary that the other parties have never been able to challenge. Certainly think the ballot title and that process is critical, and critical for court review. The other question we would have is what happens after, if there is a cap on this, so that I assume there would be no more collecting under the ballot summary after those have been filed, and the parties, the proponents rather, would then have to just wait for the ballot title process to take its course. We all know sometimes that's short, sometimes that's long, but we all have to live with that. Sometimes we might challenge our own ballot titles because we don't like them, and sometimes someone else does. Also, we want to make sure that in this process that we retain really clear opportunity language for procedural challenges to occur. Normally what happens with the ballot title process is it's really two-pronged for us sometimes. We're filing comments to the Secretary of State on the actual ballot title, and we're filing a challenge suggesting that it should not be certified for violation of either the full text, single subject requirements, and we make our case there. When and if the Secretary of State through the AG issues a certified ballot title, in fact, if they do issue a certified ballot title, we kind of know we've lost the argument on the procedural challenge, because if we want it, they won't issue it. And then we have a certain amount of time, 60 days, I believe, to go to Marion County Circuit Court and pursue a legal challenge on that. It does not delay the ballot title process or the ability to gather signatures. It's really inside baseball, unfortunately, because those we really have to follow it carefully. It's very hard for anyone who sees this and goes, oh, my gosh, we think this violates it. You have to be there at the front end and be very diligent. We try to be. So we want to make sure that that process is retained. And off the top of my head, I would think it would be more likely still at the very beginning of the process, because we certainly don't want anyone, chief petitioners on any issue, necessarily going forward if the AG has determined through the Secretary of State that it's impermissible, which they've done on a number of ones over the years. Or if we disagree, we go to court, they have at least heads up at the outset before they start collecting signatures that there's going to be a question on this. So with that, those are, I think, our biggest concerns, and hopefully those can be fixed as you move forward. And if I've misspoken on anything that's contained in the Dash 2, I'm certainly happy to be corrected if some of these issues we've raised have indeed already been addressed.
Thanks for your comments, Representative Rublin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've had some testimony about not even having ballot titles and pushing it all back to the summary is where the issue is, and just carry the summary. Would you have a problem with no ballot title?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Rublin, yes.
Okay.
Because the summary, we cannot challenge it, and it's the reliance on whoever the Attorney General is at the time and what their staff determines. And we believe that while sometimes they get it right, sometimes they get it wrong, and you don't get that challenge. And voters need to know as clearly as possible. I mean, I think Armada is a good example kind of when voters don't know and don't understand. That was the what we call the so-called crime victims that had what's called log rolling. It had a lot of issues. Some sounded really good, and some kind of got hidden. And when we had that overturned under Measure 40, Measure 40 overturned, it came back to this body. And you all decided that you were going to refer out those constitutional amendments. There were 8 of them. This body decided that one of them was not going to go forward. There were 7. ACLU and other groups opposed all of them, but we defeated, I believe it was 3 of the worst ones. So once voters knew and understood clearly the issues, and I think that having the opportunity for folks to comment, having the opportunity for the AG to get it right most of the time, but maybe not always. And again, it depends on who the AG is. And we want whatever's good for us should be good for anyone else at any given time. So having that court oversight is critical. Voters are being asked. It's very easy. Our organization and our lawyers are extremely concerned about how easy it is to amend our Oregon Constitution. And we do think that there needs to be the protection and safeguards, and that is somewhat full disclosure and understanding of what it is, and not by the proponents. And not necessarily by the opponents. It's by the collaborative effort and the review of neutral bodies.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for you, I'm going to follow up with what Representative Rublin was talking about, just to see if I can get clear, because as you discussed the process, it sort of seems so incredibly complex. And trying to think, well, isn't there a way to simplify it? So maybe that's my question. Isn't there a way to simplify it? But if you could challenge the ballot summary, if we eliminated the ballot title and you could challenge the ballot summary, would that remove one step, or would it just shift it down and the same process would repeat itself?
Chair Rosenbaum, excuse me, Vice Chair Buckley, you know, our cooperating attorneys are very concerned about the cost this is, not really to us. They do it all volunteer, but to the state.
Right.
And I would worry that what you're doing is now setting up a 2 system where there would be legal challenges to not just the ballot title, but the summary. which does nothing, I think, to aid trying to streamline it. Also, you know, the good and the bad, I think the ballot title, as I mentioned before, with that caption, the yes and no, allows readers to choose how closely they want to continue reading. A 75-word summary for some of the very more complicated issues sounds like a lot of words, but having been someone who literally tinkers with it and tries to craft all the issues that we see coming forward on initiatives, it's very challenging. So I don't necessarily off the top of my head have an alarm about the ballot summary process. I mean, I think there is legitimate concern about the ballot title shopping issue. You know, our lawyers are involved and involved more and more, and the state has to defend more and more over and over again these same things. And I understand the proponent's desire to try to require that there be some threshold. And I appreciate that at least with the ballot summary, there's an attorney general review of our comments, that we do have the opportunity to comment. That's critical. But I think adding the appeal process just slows down the process and makes it unfair for anyone trying to petition that they might be delayed at two times. Because if there's a court challenge going on with the ballot title, you cannot be active with your initiative. You haven't actually not received the certified sheets. So I don't think that would help the system in streamlining it. I must comment on your first thing. It sounds really complicated. I don't know. Once you've learned it, it seems very straightforward. At least we know what we need to do when, how the process works. And the biggest challenge for us is just the time constraint. But that's the time, you know, how quickly it must happen. And having attorneys who are well-versed on knowing how to do this. So.
One follow-up. There's been a previous discussion about the possibility of going to the voters to see if they would approve a signature gathering time of 2 years rather than the compacted schedule for a particular election cycle. Do you have any opinion on that?
Chair Rosenbaum, Vice Chair Buckley, I'm sorry, I didn't hear the previous testimony, so I'm not sure I may not be answering this correctly. I mean, technically, you have a 2-year cycle to do this.
In this case, to clarify, if it's today the 21st of February, mm-hmm. I had my sheets and I was all ready to go, I'd have from February 21st of 2007 to February 21st of 2009 to gather signatures if I needed that time, and then it would go on to the 2010 election.
Chair Rosenbaum, Vice Chair Buckley, while my organization's not discussed that particular item, and I will just speak from what I would think is a concern that we would probably be troubled by that. You're talking about getting your sheets now, collecting it over the next 2 years, then it appearing in 2010. It's a long, huge delay. There's a process now. You do have 2 years, and I have never seen the number of initiatives filed before July of the trigger date of 2006 to be prepared. You can get them in to the hopper. I'm trying to remember. I think you can even get a ballot title issued. You just can't start carrying them. We see people backing up even more. But we think the 2-year period, the process within the general election, probably shouldn't be tinkered with. And I think we just need to get – so I'm not sure I fully have answered it, but off the top of my head, I'm not thinking that would be a very great idea.
Okay.
And you know, we all struggle with that. Sometimes it takes a while and we've been on the side of trying to amend the Constitution as a proponent. And, you know, it's a struggle if the ballot title gets held up and the struggle to get the signatures, but it's part of the process. And, you know, we really just don't think there are ways to make it easier for people. We really do believe that this process needs to be more carefully tailored to do it. So that voters really are, it's not, particularly with amending the Constitution.
Other questions?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Just breezing through this short little document that Ross Day turned in. There's, expanding on previous questions, where he was suggesting maybe we would replace the ballot title process as it now stands, go with the summary thing as suggested in the -1 amendments, but they would have to be challengeable in order to avoid due process concerns. But then he says rather than use a ballot title, go to after it has qualified for the ballot with the signatures, number of signatures required. So that would kind of, you know, eliminate a lot of ballot title shopping in that way, because you would have sought for the whatever 100,000 plus signatures that you would have to have, but then at that point have an explanatory statement committee, you know, like they come up, they have that committee, as I'm looking at here, they would come up, they would perform the same legal function as the ballot title is supposed to perform, and they would come up with the ballot title. I'm just wondering if you think that that, it seems like that would eliminate ballot shopping because you have, it would be at the end of the process.
Chair Rosenbaum, Thatcher, I'm not sure. I haven't necessarily followed, but I don't have his testimony in front of me. His whole train of how that would stop it. I'm sorry, I left it at my chair. Let me talk about our concerns with turning the interpretation process over in terms of what voters can understand on what is being carried for signatures to an explanatory committee. I've been on those too. Not the most pleasant experience, I have to say. These are proponents and opponents. You are fighting for messaging. You are fighting for interpretation in your position. And then you hope you have some wise person in the middle that you all agree on. And I've been on committees where we couldn't agree, and it was just wholly unpleasant. And it became a political issue. What I continue to support and want to see is a legal interpretation. The courts have criteria to which they must use to look at what is the effect. And when we're talking about statutes and constitutional amendments, it is our court that is best equipped, and through the attorney generals, through our lawyers, I hate to promote the lawyers, but who understand the law and can look at and try to make sure that voters understand the effect, understanding current law and understanding how this would change it. And there are some that we get that none of us can quite understand what the proponents want. But I don't think that's best fleshed out when opponents and proponents duke it out in an explanatory committee with one individual. You've basically turned one person into a judge, and I'd rather have the judicial review with the full court, with those who know the case law and the history and understanding interpretation of Oregon law. So that kind of answers, I think, more of our concern why an explanatory committee would not. That's the voter pamphlet time. That's an attempt that we certainly agree with for there to be some attempted neutral presentation and then arguments. But carrying the initiative in that whole process should be as untainted as possible with the proponents and opponents being involved in crafting it. We get to put our comments in. But we don't sit there and argue and have hopefully one person who, you know, is going to pick a side. I just would rather have the court. Now, I'm streamlining it. I mean, I'm not sure his process, so let me just lay out the concern. We want an opportunity to get involved early, both on the procedural challenges. We want an opportunity early to comment and have a neutral body oversee exactly what voters are looking at. I'd be concerned that we just replace ballot title with summary. Again, let me go back to the ballot title. If you've looked at it, at least has the caption. It has the yes and it has the no. It doesn't always get it right, but at least voters who aren't interested in reading the whole thing can get a quick beat on the gist. And then it does have the summary. But if you just shove it all into 75 words with no kind of delineation of lines and bold, I think it doesn't serve the voter or the people who are asked to sign something to know. We used to have it as 85 words in the summary. We've now expanded it to 125, and similar with the caption. We need enough words. So I would not want to step backwards and say, well, let's just shorten the number of words into a ballot summary. Great as a tool for an initial outset to ensure that there's true Oregonian interest in having this circulated. But once that interest is expressed, I don't see anything particularly wrong with the ballot title process in and of itself and what it produces.
Follow up. Could you explain again? They're suggesting a 75-word summary, and you're saying that you can have 100. How many in the ballot title and then the yes and the no? Can you tell me again?
Ballot title contains a caption, 25 words. And let me just tell you, as someone who's tinkered with that, that goes pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And dashes are counted. Dashes, two words that have dashes, that's two words. So the yes and the no are... I misspoke. 15 words. 15 words on the caption. I'm sure there are people back there going, I got it wrong. 15 words. 25 on the yes and 25 on the no. And then the summary is 125 words. believe if it and I believe the you know amends constitution is what we always start out with in the caption. So the ballot title includes a caption, yes, no, and summary. People get confused, but I think it's a really good visual tool. I certainly, my organization and the lawyers who work on it haven't complained deeply about the flaws of that. We sometimes complain deeply about the flaws of how it's prepared and the response, but so be it. We all.
Okay, well, thank you.
Michelle Fallon?
So they're suggesting a 75-word summary to replace something now that is 190 words, and that's a valid concern. Because you would have less time to, or you would have, well, you know, less less explanation, I suppose. So that seems like it would be a concern.
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Thatcher, it's not for us because I think what is trying to be achieved here is that there's a threshold showing that there's interest in this. And I think it would be problematic to do issue a ballot title. I mean, let's play out the other scenario of how you kind of create a threshold before you give it the seal of approval to go collect all the signatures you need. If you did the ballot title, use that same how many words you said it total up to, 190-something, and allowed us to make comments or others to make comments on ours that we file, but then don't have a legal challenge to it. Let them go out and collect 10%. And then come back and say, well, now do that whole thing again and make comments on it. Well, everyone's put in a very difficult position, particularly the AG, who said this is what we think it is. And now we get to go to court. So I think that what the goal of this is to say, look, there's a summary. It's a little bit briefer. You will have the opportunity to comment, critical to us. You don't get the opportunity to take it to the Supreme Court, so it gets out there right away. There's not the delay. And if you can make a showing that there's sufficient Oregonian interest in it by getting the 10%, then you go through the process, the potential legal challenges, and you get the seal of approval to collect. And I think that's a way to address the concerns that certainly my organization deals with the hundreds of hours, and particularly the, you know, and I have to tell you, it's our lawyers talking about how much it's costing the state to defend all of these. And the cost to all of us as taxpayers over and over and over again on the same issues, in the same cycle, the same stuff. And so we do think that this is a good way of balancing out a threshold showing while still preserving the safeguards that we believe are currently in the system and would remain in the system. And also, I think that if the outset is when we have the opportunity to challenge it procedurally, and at that time the Secretary of State through the AG would be responsible for saying yes or no, it's procedurally okay, it needs to happen at the beginning still, because you wouldn't want someone collecting 10% or even 100%, which currently we don't do, if they believe it is unconstitutional under Oregon Constitution for violations of it, that it would be inconsistent. And folks can challenge that decision if they disagree with it, but for the most part, they just rework it. Or, you know, or if we lose that, we go to court, and sometimes we win or lose on that. So I hope I've answered your question.
No, we've had some good insight.
Okay.
Thanks. Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, we had some earlier testimony from Mr. Day regarding some of the constitutionality of things in this bill, which would include the registration of paid signature gatherers. Has your organization looked at that from the same perspective, or do you see that as an issue?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Roblin, has my organization looked at that? To be honest, we've not had a chance to fully vet. I've asked, you know, I have to say about 6 days ago, I sent out the electronic version of this to a number of our cooperating attorneys and said, could you all take a look at this? And not surprisingly, if they opened it up and saw 60 pages, no one's gotten back to me yet. I've gotten some insight on some other aspects that have raised with them. You know, the free speech issues are always critical and important to us. I'm sorry that I could not attend to be part of earlier testimony or be part of involvement in this initiative or this bill beforehand. So, you've got three lawyers, you have four different opinions. So, and I wasn't the Meyer in that case in Colorado either. Like you were not. Although, as I said, I'm the Meyer on a more recent challenge, and I'm not thrilled with that one. So, I think it's something we will look at, and maybe as this bill moves and it's reprinted and a little bit more accessible, there'll be an opportunity for our cooperating volunteer attorneys who are quite busy to hopefully take a look and give us any insight they have, as well as others.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who, that completes our sign-up, is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2082? All right.
That's here.
Please come forward.
Madam Chair, yes. I have a technical question. I was just coming forward.
Sure.
Does the dash 2, which I haven't read yet, completely replace the dash 1?
It does.
Thank you.
It does.
That
it
helps
incorporates.
It helps me.
Lessen
the amount of the size
right.
of my file.
You can touch the dash 1 if you wish. Okay, please identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
My name is Charlene Crocker. I live at 4081 Alderbrook, Southeast Salem, 97302. And I've been a citizen in Salem for 19 years and in Corvallis prior to that.
Great.
And
welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. I'm a volunteer signature gatherer for many petitions that have occurred over the years. And just giving my own personal feeling about the bill, it is just way too hard for a volunteer to do all the things that I saw in the summary. You know, mainly I gather signatures with people I know, you know, let's say in my Bible study, my church, wherever I go, these people, I know them, I know what their signature looks like because I see them sign their name every single day. So it's easy for me to collect signatures right now with the present system because I can check who they are. I know their face. I know their signature. And I just ask them to sign a petition paper. And I think a majority of the people I worked with on a most recent one were the same way. We're in places where we see people and we know who they are. And, you know, we want that to continue to be a simple process where people don't have to stop and give us a whole bunch of information or, you know, before they sign something. You know, they're able to read it. I always have it on the table where they can read the whole thing or just part of it, whatever they want to do. So this makes it a pleasant experience. We can smile and talk, chat about our families. We don't just have to start looking at their driver's license or making sure their signatures match. I mean, it just they can ask me more questions about the bill, and I can talk to them, you know, about it. So it's a good process for us the way it is now. I'm sure there are things that could be tightened up, but this particular version is way too difficult, and I don't do it for pay, so I'm not worried about if you want to put more restrictions on the pay one, that's okay, but I think volunteers need to have it so it's a friendly process and you know, that we're not irritating all our friends.
And to clarify, a lot of the changes in the bill don't apply to volunteers. So I'm not sure everything that you're worried about would affect you anyway.
Okay, well.
Are there specific things that you're concerned about?
I think it would be difficult for me to find out if they'd registered. That's what it sounded like when I read the summary with the Secretary of State. I don't know if that's me or them, but.
Well, I think, I mean, that actually is a requirement under current law that only registered voters are signing these petitions.
Registered voters. Oh, I thought I had to register, come in here and register.
No, the registration process is for paid signature gatherers, so that wouldn't apply to volunteers. Yes, Representative Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In fact, as I look at it, the biggest change for a volunteer would be that the person filling, signing out their signature would have to fill out the whole line, including their address and so on themselves. Do most of your people do that already?
Yes, I think so. I mean, maybe they forget once, but, you know, most of the time somebody notices it and tells us to come back and do that.
Okay, that's what I thought. And that's really the biggest change, I think, from a volunteer person.
Representative Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you ever, if one of your neighbors, you know, signs, but they leave out what state it is or their zip or whatever, do you ever write that in?
No.
Vice Chair Berger.
One of the provisions in this that I think is difficult for, you clearly are somebody who has done this before, knows the form. most volunteers don't. In other words, they haven't done it before and they don't know the form as well. One of the provisions in here that gives me a lot of heartache, I'll be honest with you, is that, you can't have any scratch-outs or changing or any... We've seen evidence of fraudulent, you know, sheets, but in that, embedded within that, are sheets that I think were not fraudulent, just mistakes. If your sheets couldn't have, like, a cross-out anywhere, would that bother you?
Yes, I think maybe that would be the biggest problem for us, because if you're sitting in a area where there might be three or four counties and somebody starts signing on the X county but they should have signed on the other county Y, then you're saying I couldn't just say cross that off, come over here and sign on this sheet, and then the next person below that just starts signing. So those crossouts would be disqualified.
Although, actually, we're doing away with the separate sheets for separate counties, so you wouldn't have to worry about that.
Yes, yes, Madam Chair, if I could pursue this. However, as the witnesser of the signatures, if you changed that date, that would invalidate the entire sheet. And I think that is just contrary. I just think that's way over the top. Thank you.
Okay, yes.
Okay, further questions? Okay, thank you very much for your
testimony. Thank you very much.
And, colleagues, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2082. We will not be taking this bill up today in a work session, but the next time it's scheduled, we will be. So please make sure that you have a chance to review the amendments and come forward with any concerns you have. We do have another bill to hear, and therefore I'll open a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2589. Shana, do we have anyone on the sign-up sheet? Do we have anyone in the audience that is here to testify on House Bill 2589? No. Then, colleagues, we are in a work session on House Bill 2589. We had quite a bit of testimony on this bill the other day. I am prepared to work it today and will entertain a motion. Are there motions?
Chair Buckley. Madam Chair, I'd move House Bill 2589 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Buckley moves House Bill 2589 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Vice Chair Berger.
Yes, Madam Chair. After listening to the testimony and putting pretty clearly on the record that this, in my mind, is not about policy, it's about public perception. And while public perception is a huge problem, I do not believe, as written, that this is the bill that gets us there. It does not have the language that we worked on with the Law Commission, which was better language, more generic. Contrary to public perception, other than public perception, we heard absolutely no testimony that anyone ever thought anything was given or taken in this process. One of the reasons in my mind that legislators become lobbyists is this is a complex, complicated business down here. And you acquire knowledge by being an elected official that is useful in understanding how this process works. It's in some ways the same as anybody applying for a job learns. You learn it by doing it. You learn to be an engineer first by training and then by being an engineer, and that makes you valuable by way of the skills that you've acquired. I can't support this bill as written. I'm sorry. I hope that the Law Commission language gets better sort of purchase later on. So I just, heads up, I can't support this bill as written.
Okay, duly noted. Other comments? Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I had raised a question here during our public hearing about people were coming to this body and developing and getting hired into a position, an appointment of a department head or something of that nature. I think if we're going to go by perception, to me, that would be a perception that people would look at. The only reason you're here is because you're a legislator, and the only reason you've been advanced is because you were a legislator. Now, that opens some very interesting slopes, I think, and I think they need to be treated the same. There's no difference between being a legislator and coming in as a lobbyist to me, if we're going to talk about perception, or the perception that I was a legislator, maybe I voted a certain way and ended up being a department head. I'm not sure that there's the distinction in the mind of the public, and we are talking about perception here. We are not talking about actuality, so I'm still concerned about that particular issue.
Thank you. And Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I had offered up the Dash 2 amendments to actually address a revolving door rather than just a one-way swinging door where it would apply only to legislators becoming lobbyists after they're serving their term until, you know, a session later, and actually apply it to lobbyists being appointed by the legislative or executive branches. The point being, I haven't heard a lot of scandal or bad perceptions. I haven't read about them anyway, where you've got legislators becoming lobbyists and that's causing a problem. I have, however, heard about lobbyists becoming appointees in the process in several papers, you know, very recently, Statesman Journal. I mean, there's perception out there that there was payback for support in, you know, the governor's campaign, and some of those lobbyists are then working in his office. And that is a perception that was written about in several papers. I just haven't seen it being a scandal or public perception where a negative public perception of legislators becoming lobbyists after their term. So I thought, well, if we're going to go down this road, let's at least be consistent. And I'm not wild about restricting somebody's ability to make a living after, you know, serving in the public body. But I was going to say, if you just want to go down that road, at least be consistent and apply it to lobbyists becoming appointees in the legislative or executive branches as well.
Other comments? And Representative Roblin, were you on?
Yeah, I just want to make one. I find myself ready to vote for this bill. And in large part, it has to do, and again, it's perception. The thing that I really wanted to say today was, you know, I've worked with, in now two sessions, some great people. And I really think it is perception, because the people I know here on both sides of the aisle are dedicated to what they do. They care about their constituents, and they care about the state of Oregon. And that's been impressive to me. And when you come here the first time, you're not sure that that's what you're going to find, because you hear all these things out there. And I think people who spend time here recognize, on both sides, and including the lobby, you find really exceptional people who care about public policy and doing the right things. May not always agree, but that doesn't mean that their heart and other things aren't in it. The issue that I have that comes out to me a lot of times to people, though, was the one that I mentioned the last meeting, and that is that people perceive that there are times when tough votes are taken, and that a person leaves here the next day and gets hired right away, and that vote that they took may have had the influence and became the vote they took because of a job that they had promised for that. And I think we hear more of that at the federal government level than we do at our state. But removing that perception, from my perspective, is a really good thing, and it's good for all of us. It continues to work on the stuff that we've already been doing with regard to rules here to try to make and bring back that belief by the public that we really came here to do good things for the state and the people of Oregon. And I haven't yet found a perfect bill. I keep looking for one. And hopefully we'll get there sometime. But this goes in the direction that I think we need to go. So thank you.
Thank you. Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's extremely important to make a distinction between the legislative branch and the executive branch. We are doing the people's business. We're sent here by our districts. And I think that's a very different situation than being the executive who has an administration to run and who actually appoints people with expertise to take on jobs within the administration. Totally different process. And the issue for me is access. any of my colleagues on this committee or any of the colleagues we serve with now, I'd be very hard pressed 2 years from now to say truthfully I would not give access to my office to my co-vice chair or any other people on this committee if they had retired and become a lobbyist, because I have a connection to you. Whereas time is very limited, and we all schedule back to back to back to back, and you have to at some point say, I can't see anybody else today. My colleagues, my former colleagues, would be high on that list as part of human nature. And I think in terms of the public perception of who gets access to their representative, I think this is a very valid choice for us to make, to say, we need legislation to take a time out so we have a little bit of breathing space between our work together on committees such as these and our future work, where you might be coming to me on behalf of a special interest that wants my vote on something. It's harder for me to deny you access because of that relationship. I'm very strongly in support of this bill.
Yes, Representative Hunt.
I'll buy into the peer pressure of everyone speaking and speaking over this too. I think it's important to remember this original idea, at least in terms of the Oregon legislation, was not just birthed this session. It was birthed 4 years ago when there was a very real problem of a sitting Speaker of the House being hired to lobby for an organization. I think the ensuing years have illustrated more problems at the federal level, as Representative Roblin talked about, a series of very specific, I would argue probably more than, certainly huge perception problems, I would probably argue even more than perception, but real conflict of interest issues in terms of legislators moving into lobby positions. So I think there's been at least one clear instance at the state level. There have been a whole series of problems at the federal level. And I think this is, in this area, it's going to be true, like a lot of the areas where we deal with ethics issues. We're going to have to decide, you know, if we're going to err, are we going to err more on the side of caution or err more on the side of just kind of a relaxed standard? And I think this is one of those areas where if we are going to err, I think this bill errs on the side of caution. And the time to solve this is when there are not 15 examples of this rolling out. The time to address it is as a precautionary preventive measure. And I think it's a good approach. I'm glad. I mean, the one difference now from 4 years ago is you have actually heard the bill, Madam Chair. And so I think it's a good opportunity to move forward, make a statement, not a statement that is trying to present Representative Roblin or Representative Esquall or anybody else from becoming a lobbyist per se, but just raising ourselves to a higher standard for the public.
Thank you. Committee members, I think we have had an excellent discussion. Your comments have been very thoughtful. And I think that this is the Committee on Elections Ethics and Rules, and that this bill fits well within the purview. I think we're all well aware of some problems with the public perception of this body, and that this bill will go a ways to restore some public confidence. It doesn't prevent, as others have said, anybody from being able to lobby. It just represents a hiatus from your legislative service until you can begin to do that. And certainly, let me make it clear that we are not casting aspersions on anyone in this body, but I do think it's important that we apply this bill to ourselves to make it clear that we hold ourselves to the same standard we would anybody else. And so, therefore, I think we are ready to vote on the bill, and the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Buckley?
Aye.
No. Representative Hunt?
Aye.
Representative Roblin?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
No.
Representative Berger?
No.
Chair Rosenbaum?
Aye. Motion carries. And the bill will go to the floor with a due pass recommendation. The chair will carry the bill. I'm sorry, Representative Thatcher?
I'm sorry. I'm just wondering if we could serve notice of a potential minority report, just to reserve that.
You certainly can.
Well, I know. Thank you.
Notice the SERP. Okay. And the chair will carry the bill, and I will close the work session on House Bill 2589. Having nothing further to come before us today, we are adjourned.